state is given by the wave function and the configuration of the system, when the configuration is simply the positions of all the particles. And the evolution of the that's different stuff. You make me crazy. Okay. The evolution equation is the following. You have Schrödinger's equation for the wave function, and I won't explicitly give what the Hamiltonian is, but basic structures like that. And you have the evolution equation of the following form. First order evolution equation for the configuration. The key thing is you have the right hand side, some vector field or configuration space, some expression involving psi, which governs the motion. And I wrote down explicitly what that was last time, and I won't write it down again. I'll say now only that I'll mention only one crucial feature of it. This is J, the quantum probability current, some explicit expression in terms of psi, which I gave last time, which you learned about possibly before, divided by rho, that is psi squared, the usual quantum probability gets. That's the form of the theory. That's the essential structure. And as I explained last time, one could think of this theory as the following thing. The obvious ontology is particles given by their positions, which requires no imagination to think of that. If you talk about a system of particles, you think you're talking about single positions. Obvious ontology evolving in the obvious way, as I explained last time, it requires no imagination to come up with that equation either. So I think it's good to think of Bohm mechanics as a version of quantum mechanics, completion of Schrodinger's equation to something with a little more. And that little more is the obvious ontology evolving in the obvious way. Okay. Now, I also mentioned last time that J of rho, as an immediate consequence of a Schrodinger's equation, satisfied the quantum continuity equation, the erodic key plus the divergence of J equals zero. Okay. I mentioned also that Bohmian mechanics is empirically equivalent to orthodox quantum theory. It makes the same predictions. Didn't explain why at all. Just a blanket statement which needs to be at least a little bit conveyed. I mentioned some specific things. I don't want to repeat them all here, but mention a few of them. In particular, as a consequence of Bohmian mechanics, one obtains that, the usual formulas of correlation of quantum mechanics, operators as observables. That emerges from analysis of this theory. Collapse of the wave function. Even though it seems to be incompatible with the basic equation, which is a deterministic equation involving no collapse for the wave function. And as another consequence of the theory I mentioned last time, absolute uncertainty, which I vaguely specified what that was, and said that there was an aspect of quantum randomness. And I want to say a little bit more today about quantum randomness. We won't have time to give a full discussion. That would take several weeks. Now, I want to make two points before I begin a more systematic development. The first point is this. What is the role? Let me contrast for you the role of the wave function in Bohmian mechanics with the role of the wave function in standard textbook quantum theory. It obviously has a role in both. Here, the role is quite clear. It's made explicit by this equation. It's the thing you use to generate the motion that gives you the right-hand side of the basic equation of motion of the most important particle theory, the positions of the particles. It tells the particles how to move. That's why it's often called the pilot wave. You could say it choreographs the motion. That's all expressed by saying you have an equation with this. That's exactly what I mean. In orthodox quantum theory, the wave function also has a role. The role's a little bit different. It also governs the behavior of something. What would that be? observance of the behavior of measurements, I would say, or of macroscopic variables. For Bohr, for the Copenhagen interpretation, you might say for textbook quantum theory, macroscopic variables have to be taken as given, and the wave function governs what happens to them as you go, as you do one measurement followed by another measurement that gives you probability relationships. You learned about the probability rules of quantum mechanics for all sorts of measurements, all measuring all kinds of observables. Those are probability rules which express the role of the wave function in orthodox quantum theory. The role of the wave function in orthodox quantum theory concerns certain observables, quantities. They're on the macroscopic level. Here, they're on the microscopic level. I consider that actually a distinct advantage. The role of a theory which is fundamentally about the microscopic level should be on objects on that level, the microscopic level. That makes the theory more precise because you can find the position of particles a precise notion. The notion of the macroscopic is an intrinsically vague notion. How big does something have to be macroscopic? If anybody said it's precisely this big and no smaller, you would think they're crazy. It's not a precise notion. Okay. One other remark concerning absolute certainty. Let me at least make it vaguely plausible to you that it's at least not impossible if you could have something like absolute certainty. I said last time that you have a wave function like that spread out. You can't possibly know that the position is in some small interval, much smaller than the spread of the wave function. You can't know that. No matter what tools you have at your disposal, no matter what tricks you devise, you will not be able to come arrive at a situation where you know the particle's there for the wave function like that. Think about how you would go about obtaining that information. You would do something like position measurement. What do you already know about what happens to the position measurement? I'm not saying you couldn't measure the wave, the position of the particle. The important point is that if you did somehow try to measure the position of the particle and you did find out it was in this narrow interval, you will in fact, as a consequence of the theory, you will in fact change the wave function so that afterwards the wave function is going to be supported on the interval corresponding to what you know. And so there will be no inconsistency. You'll be in a situation where the wave function is this narrow thing here and you know what you know is perfectly consistent. The wave function will change. Okay. Now I want to address some of these things, some in a more detailed way, some in a rather sketchy way. I guess I want to start with quantum randomness and the issue of Bohmian mechanics or orthodox quantum theory being equivalent empirically. The key to understanding this, on both a simple level and the crucial ingredient on a more complicated level, is that there's a special probability distribution in quantum mechanics, rho equals psi squared. That's special. It has a certain feature which distinguishes it from other possible probability distributions. This is a mathematical statement. Here is the statement. With respect, for every wave function psi, we can associate probability distribution rho psi, namely psi squared. This association has the following property. Let's say it this way. If we take rho psi, we can evolve rho psi to time t in two different ways. We can imagine evolving the wave function time t and looking at the corresponding rho, rho of psi t, the probability distribution corresponding to that new wave function. Or we could do the following. We can take this initial probability distribution and have the initial configuration, which is random with this distribution, flow according to the Bohm equation of motion for our initial wave function psi. You have the equation of motion, so the configuration will flow along, probabilities will flow with the configuration, you get a new probability distribution, which I'll write that way. Those are equal, they're the same. That's an important feature of particular probability distributions, particular association between psi and probabilities, rho psi, psi squared, is called equivariance. rope side, this particular choice is equivariant. Yes. I will, yes. What I'm doing here is I have a probability distribution initially, then I have a motion. Probabilities will flow under the motion. Right? If any kind of motion, I mean, for example, if I know something is over here, and the motion carries it over here, probability distribution initially calculated over here will be carried by the flow to where stuff goes. That's what's on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, I forget about any flow. This, I don't need to talk about any flow here. I have a wave function. It evolves according to Schrodinger's equation. So I can consider psi squared initially, and I consider psi initially, let it flow to a later time, and then look at the probability distribution corresponding to the new psi. I'm going to write down what this says in another way, which is more directly applicable. It means the following. It means that if Q, the configuration, at any time t, is psi t squared distributed. Psi squared distributed. Distributed at one time, any time, at some single time, then Q is psi squared distributed at any time, all time. If at one time, say your initial time, you have psi squared distribution at that time, then that would be true at all times. You know that the probability will be at all times, you know what it was initially, if it's this probability. In particular, if psi t squared weren't changing, which would be the case if you had a stationary state, since the change in the wave function is kind of trivial, just an arbitrary phase, psi squared doesn't change. If you have a stationary state, psi squared doesn't change. This says that the probability of the distribution of qt won't change. Stationary distribution, it's the same for all time. What this is, another way of saying it is, psi, the distribution of the configuration, this probability changes only to the extent that the wave function changes. The wave function doesn't change in a significant way, the probability doesn't change. It keeps up with the wave function. This is useful for all kinds of purposes, practical. It says without solving the equations of motion, you can still sort of figure out what happens in many situations by just seeing what the wave function is doing, because the motion has to keep up with the wave function. It's also extremely useful for any kind of a theoretical analysis, as you would imagine. It's the key property that this wave function, this particular probability distribution has. And it plays the role that stationarity has for a dynamical system which has autonomous equations of motion. And if the autonomous equations of motion, the right-hand side would not change with time. Let me emphasize here that this right-hand side changes with time precisely because the wave function might change with time. If the wave function didn't change with time in a serious way, you'd have an autonomous system. You'd talk about stationary states. If the wave function does change with time, it wouldn't make sense to think about stationary probability distributions. So this is the right concept for that situation. Equivariance is just a natural generalization state of stationarity to an appropriate setting. And it plays exactly the same role as stationarity would in an analysis where you're having in a situation where you have an autonomous dynamical system. So I usually just think equivariance just means it's like stationarity. Now, why is this true? This is a very simple property. What you have to show is that this probability distribution, psi t squared, is rope moves with the flow. Equations of motion. Yeah. Yeah, it'd be distracting for me, but how many people want to see the screen shut down? How many people don't want to shut down? How many people do not want the screen shut down? How many people do want it shut down? No, I think we should leave it. Right. What do we have to show? We want to show that the motion that carries this probability distribution psi t squared along. That it's a solution to the equation of motion for the probability distribution. But what is the equation of motion for a probability distribution under a flow? Let's say dq dt equals v, which may or may not depend on time, a general flow. Well, most of you know how probabilities flow. They flow the way fluids flow. You have a fluid density rho. How will the fluid flow? It will be given by the classical continuity equation, d rho dt plus the divergence of the density rho times V equals zero. That's just the equation of motion. For fluid density under a flow, it's the equation of motion as well. For probability density under a flow, that's the equation with rho equals psi squared, which has to satisfy. We'll put a t there, is actually a t there. Rho equals psi squared should satisfy this. Well, does it? Let's see. If rho is psi squared, this velocity v is the bone velocity, j over rho. Then what we have here, rho times v is j. This is psi squared. This is this equation, then is this equation. This equation is satisfied. That equation is satisfied. Psi t squared is the solution of the evolution equation. So psi t squared are the flowing probabilities. If at one time you have psi squared, at all times you have psi squared. So that's an immediate consequence of this theory, trivial consequence. But it says it actually implies a lot. It doesn't imply that you have that Bohmian mechanics is equivalent to Laplace quantum theory in the strongest sense, which is true, but it is equivalent in the strongest sense. That requires work. What it does imply is that it's that Bohmian mechanics is a counterexample to all the Noetic variable theories. It's except they say something like Bohmian mechanics is impossible. Bohmian mechanics reproduces all the probabilities of experiments that the no-hidden variables theorem say cannot be reproduced by hidden variables. Why is that? Well, let's just think about any such experiment. An experiment will involve a system, which you're going to do something, you're going to interact with it, you're going to do some measurement on it, and an apparatus. There'll be some initial state of the system and apparatus. I don't really care with the details. There'll be some initial wave function for the whole composite thing, the big system. The biggest system relative to the analysis. So you include in the apparatus everything you need to do the analysis on. So that's the initial state, psi. Say t equals zero, we have psi. We have the initial q. And its distribution. Suppose its distribution at time zero. Suppose the distribution of the configuration at time zero is psi squared. Suppose the initial distribution is psi squared. So that defines our probability space. We're talking about measurements. Initial distribution psi squared. The points of the probability space are the configurations, the positions of the particles, they're randomly distributed this way. Then the experiment will end at some time, capital T. And there'll be some wave function at that time, psi capital T. And there'll be some configuration at that time, q capital T. And then what will the distribution then be of the configuration at that time? Well, by what I just said over there, it'll be given by psi squared at that time. So the Bohmian prediction for the result of this experiment, if you initially had this distribution, psi squared, that defined your probability space, will be psi squared distribution for later time. That's the distribution for the detailed configuration. It's in particular distribution of any function of the configuration, for example, the orientation of a pointer, or whatever else you use to re-register the results, to record the results of the experiment. This implies in particular, though, that the Bohmian prediction for the results of the experiment, given by psi squared, consists of psi squared, must agree with the quantum mechanical prediction for the results of the experiment, which must be given by psi squared. Therefore, this theory provides a hidden variable model and that with this probability space, the results of all measurements will agree with the Bohmian mechanics of our counterexample to all the statements. Trivial counter. Absolutely trivial counter.
Okay.
So, what we can say is the following, that Bohmian mechanics is equivalent to, empirically equivalent to orthodox quantum theory, modulo, let's say it this way, modulo psi squared. Modulo, let's say, modulo rho equals psi squared. If probabilities, at least initially, are given by psi squared, then you're going to have empirical equivalence. So this is an important, I've said already this is an important distribution. Let's give it a name. Rho equals applies to it. The particular probability distribution is the quantum equilibrium distribution. The natural terminology is associated with Bohm mechanics. This, so far as I know, maybe Anthony can correct me here, it was introduced at about the same time by myself and my Detlef and Nino and by Anthony. I'm not aware of it being used earlier. I find it an odd coincidence. The very same year, this totally appropriate terminology was introduced, some 40 years after it should have been introduced. But that's just a question of publication, maybe. Okay. So it's clear, if you want to sharpen this understanding of this equivalence, you're going to have to get to a deeper understanding of, is this true? When should it be true? How true is it? They call that the problem of quantum equilibrium. The problem, again, is this. Take the equation rho equals psi squared. We call that the quantum equilibrium hypothesis. Somehow rho equals right psi squared is the right probability distribution to use. There are two problems with this. It's not clear what it means. You may think you know what it means, but it's not very clear what it means. So if you're actually trying to prove that thing for a while, the first thing you recognize is you don't know what you're trying to prove. Good to realize you don't know what you mean yet. You have to narrow fit to know what you mean. Once you figure out what the other means, you get the right notion. You still have to justify it. You have to understand why should it be true. That's a long story, which we will not be able to get into in any detail here. But I want to say a little bit about why it's a problem, what it means. Let's ask ourselves, what system should we be thinking of this as applying to, rho equals psi squared? Well, no system. The equations of Bohmian mechanics, if Bohmian mechanics is the theory governing the universe, the equations of Bohmian mechanics would only apply to closed systems. Their interactions with the environment and then these equations wouldn't be correct. You'd have to take into account the environment in some way, the more complicated equation. Well, there's one system, and every subsystem of the universe interacts with the environment, however weak. No system is absolutely closed. The only system to which, in a Bohmian universe, these equations exactly apply would be to the universe as a whole. So one might first ask, okay, let's see, maybe we should demand that this be true for the universe as a whole. But then you ask, what the hell should the probability distribution, the configuration of the universe as a whole be? That was the concluding question at their lecture, the public lecture last night by Lenny Susskind. So we have only one universe. To talk about probabilities, you think you need statistics, samples, lots of universes. What does it mean to talk about an ensemble of universes? We're stuck in one universe. So it's not clear what rho means if we apply this to the universal level. Of course, all the evidence for psi-squared probabilities does not come from looking at the configuration of the universe. It comes from looking at large collections of similar systems paired with the same wave function. Then you do get statistics. You have different configurations, different results from different systems. You get statistics. You look, you see, you find psi-squared. The problem here then becomes the following. For a system governed by Bohmian mechanics, where the basic equations are on the universal level, what do you even mean by the wave function of a subsystem of that universe? You're not free to say, look, if I have a Bohmian universe, I'll impose this additional requirement that every subsystem also be governed by Bohmian mechanics. Once you've got the law for the whole, for the big system, for the whole universe, whatever happens for a subsystem of the universe has to follow as a consequence of that law. It may or may not be consistent with Bohmian mechanics for a subsystem. You have to look and see what you get. And in particular, in seeing what you get, you have to figure out what you should mean by the wave function of a subsystem of the Bohmian universe, which a priori only has a wave function for the big system for the whole universe. So I'm going to come back to that. That analysis is crucial to understanding the problem of quantum equilibrium, what rho equals psi squared means and why it should be true. But it's also clearly, it's also crucial to understanding collapse of the wave function. What wave function collapses? Okay. But before coming back, before doing that, I want to make at least to give you a few deeper indications of how you might think about the quantum equilibrium hypothesis. growing for society today. What does it mean to have a deterministic, how can you have a deterministic dynamical system where you're saying that the probabilities are here, the probabilities are playing a crucial role, they're psi squared? How could that come about? Let me first give you two sort of analogies of a very different kind. At the end of the day, the following is a very, is a more or less good, a pretty good analogy for what, how you should think, how you should think about the psi squared. Wow, psi squared probabilities. You should think that quantum problems, quantum equilibrium, psi squared probabilities as analogous to probability distribution for the velocities of a particle in a gas. Have a particle in a gas at a temperature, you have a gas at temperature T. The velocities are not all the same. There's a famous distribution spread in the velocities. It's the most famous distribution of probability theory. It's the Maxwellian distribution. It's this. It's proportional to e to the minus mv squared, where m is the mass of the particles and the atoms, over kt. In exactly the same way, and for exactly the same reason, that the velocity distribution for particles in a gas are characterized by statistical behavior. Velocities for particles in a gas are characterized by statistical behavior given by this formula. Bohmian particles with wave function width, where the wave function of psi are governed by that behavior. At the end of the day, that's a perfect analogy. So you can think it's sort of like that. So the extent that you can understand this, you can understand that. This is controversial. It's understandable. It is controversial. This is controversial. It's the same controversy. Now, another way of thinking about it, rather different, still worth thinking about. It's familiar that dynamical systems, that is deterministic dynamical systems, such as Bohmian mechanics is, but such as the kind of thing studied as chaos theory, nonlinear dynamics, ergodic theory, something that's come quite fast in the past 30 years. That deterministic dynamical systems quite naturally give rise to random behavior governed by V or A. It's usually V because it's usually unique. Stationary measure. Stationary probability distribution. As I've indicated to you here, the thing that plays the role of a stationary probability distribution is the equivariant distribution psi squared. So one shouldn't be too astonished to find that for this Bohmian dynamical system, you have random behavior governed by the equivariant distribution. And that's exactly what happens. Okay, and that shouldn't be controversial. I don't think it is. Is it, Anthony? No, it's not. Okay, good. No. I don't think we want to get into that here, nor do I want to get into the why. This is an hour discussion, and we should be able to say a little bit more. But the world does not have to be, a gas does not have to be in equilibrium at temperature T. Similarly, the universe would not have, does not have to be in quantum equilibrium at all. But for the same reason that in some, it's a deeply puzzling question why the universe is not in thermodynamic equilibrium. Thermodynamic equilibrium being overwhelmed the most likely possibility. It would be puzzling if the universe were not in quantum equilibrium. On the other hand, we know that the universe is not in classical equilibrium, and that was important for some things. And it could be the case that we're not in quantum equilibrium, and that would have profound implications and give rise to all kinds of interesting possibilities. Is this a controversial thing? You agree with what I just said, don't you? I certainly agree with it. Okay, good. No, let me go on, Anthony, because to have a serious discussion would take a long time. Okay. I think that's all I really do want to say further about the origin of the probabilities beyond one additional clean mathematical statement relating to the wave function of a subsystem, which I want to get to now. All right, so let's consider a Boolean universe whose configuration is Q. And that Q represents the positions of all the particles in the universe. Now let's think of some reasonable substance like this room, or more reasonable substance like some particular hydrogen atom. Whatever subsystem we imagine implies we have a splitting into the configuration of the subsystem. So X represents the configuration of the subsystem, the position of all its particles, and then there's the rest of the positions and configuration of the rest of the stuff in the world, Y. So this refers to the subsystem, the system of interest, not the whole universe, and Y is the environment, everything else. So if we're thinking about a subsystem, we have this splitting. And of course, we have a similar splitting to the dummy variable which goes in the wave function. And we have the wave function of the whole thing, which is the universe, which is a function of Q. And that's an objective feature of the universe, according to Bohmian mechanics. There's this wave function. And again, what else do we have in a Bohmian universe? I've written, again, X and Y. This is our data. That's all the three of the Bohmian universe. That and everything implied by that. That's at stake. And now we want to ask ourselves, what could we possibly mean by the wave function of the subsystem of this universe, of the X system? This is, what should we mean by its wave function? Well, if anything, it should be some function of X. We're looking for something which is like the Bohmian wave function, or mechanical wave function, so it should be some function of X. Now think about the question. This is all we have at our disposal. That's all that's real. We're trying to build out of this junk a function of X. There are only two obvious guesses. One, the first guess people make is wrong. Second guess is right. What's the right guess? Okay, the right guess, you take your wave function of the universe, you're supposed to get out a function of X, you stick in the configuration of the environment, the actual configuration of the environment. That's a well-defined notion, because everything involved in it is well-defined. It happens to be the case that not only is it well-defined, it's exactly the right notion. Now, why is it the right notion? Because it does the right things, and I have to explain to you what things it does. This is something we call the conditional wave function of the subsystem. Probably just call it for short, that we have wave function of the subsystem. Why conditional? It's sort of like when you condition probability theory, you stick in something once one of the variables is conditional. There's another reason for calling it that, you'll see in a second. But the first thing, if this is to be anything like the wave function of a system, in order for a Bohmian, let me write down one of the basic Bohmian equations again, the Q dt equals d psi Q, which is just some specific functional psi, the right-hand side what I dealt down explicitly last time for the Bohm equation of motion. If this is to be like the wave function of a subsystem, it ought to be the x dt, the equation, the evolution equation for the subsystem ought to be that form, and it is indeed. The wave function of the subsystem psi defined this way is such that the evolution is given by the wave function, that wave function in the way. This is a triviality check, and I suggest you do it as homework. I mentioned some homework thing last night. They could be kind of hard. This one is not hard. It's total easy to do. That's one simple fact. Here's another fact. Consider a probability space with probability distribution P. Probability distribution is the following. The space you should think of as the space of Qs, which are initial configurations of the universe. Initial configurations, think of the universe starting at a certain time, is an initial configuration. In the Boolean universe, everything is going to be determined as a series deterministic by that initial configuration and the initial wave function of the universe, psi 0. This is P is the probability distribution correspondent that you get for trajectories coming from psi 0 squared, from the initial quantum equilibrium distribution. This is a certain probability distribution. Yeah. No, it's always true. It's an easy exercise. But you should ignore. Let's say ignoring spin, okay? Ignoring spin, which I think would naturally do anyway. Ignoring spin is a total triviality. Let's think about solar front figure 2 entity, okay? Okay. So I have initial configurations of the universe distributed in a psi squared way. I ask, in this probability space, let's consider evolving to time t, and ask about the probability distribution of the configuration of my system at time t, conditioned on the configuration of the full environment at time t. You might think this would be a useful mathematical object to have, and it would be, and it is, and it's trivial, here's what it is. This is exactly equal to, given by the quantum equilibrium distribution corresponding to the conditional wave function at time t. This is also a very easy thing to say. Why is that? This initial distribution of psi 0 of xy squared, you evolve at time t, you get psi t of xy squared, because that evolution preserves the psi squared probability. So you have to, for the psi t of xy squared probability, you want to look at the conditional probability, conditional of the particular value of y. So you stick that value of y in the probability place, in the right place, and what you're going to get is something involving sticking y and psi. That's wonderful. There's one thing you might be worried about, normalization. You shouldn't. I define this without normalizing it, because normalization is just a matter of convenience. When you talk about the wave function system, you should think the normalization is irrelevant. If you want to talk about probabilities, you normalize it, otherwise you don't have to worry. So this equation doesn't depend on whether psi is normalized or not. It's multiplied psi by a constant, the same equation. So psi and a constant times psi should be thought of the same thing. And you normalize as convenient. And so here, since this is a probability formula, you should think of things having been normalized. Okay. This is merely a mathematical statement, which is a crucial tool of further analysis, which will not be done here. It, however, is extremely suggestive. Yes. That's a good question. But we do actually have knowledge sometimes. Maybe when I give the explanation of why this is suggestive, your question will be answered. Why is this suggestive? Suppose we wanted to consider what the distribution of the configuration of the subsystem. And suppose we just assume this was the right probability distribution to be using. Big assumptions, not even clear what that means, so don't worry about it right now. We're not going into that. Let's just say that's the right way to compute the problem. Now, we never ask what's the distribution of the configuration of the subsystem given nothing, because if we don't know anything, we can't say anything. We always have more information. We better have some information. We better know we're talking about a system here, not a system there. We've got to know something. Well, this says if we know everything about the configuration of the environment, which I think if you think about it, you realize that's far more than we could possibly have access to. Even if we know everything about the configuration of the environment, all the conditional probability distribution is still just psi squared. That strongly suggests that no matter how much you know, no matter what you can't know, you can't overcome psi squared probability. And at the end of the day, that's right. But again, much more work is involved, but I do insist that's highly suggestive. It's an extremely simple and extremely powerful formula. Okay. Now, that's all I'm going to say about quantum randomness. Now I want to focus a little bit more on the way the wave function of the subsystem, this formula depends upon time. It depends on time in two ways. It depends on time because the wave function of the universe might depend on time. And it depends on time because the configuration of the environment will change, typically change with time. You would therefore expect to have a robust, something sort of complicated kind of evolution, depending on time in two different ways. And in fact, the following is true. In certain situations, those situations where the system, X system, is sufficiently decoupled from its environment, the conditional wave function evolves according to the Schrödinger revolution. This requires a little work, but just a little to show, but it comes would come as no surprise to anybody. That's just what you would expect. On the other hand, in other kinds of situations where we interact with the system in just the right way, namely the very kind of interactions which we call measurement procedures, when we interact that way, this evolves in a very different way. It collapses in just the textbook manner. So when I say that collapse is a consequence of Bohmian mechanics, exactly that, that's exactly what I mean. When you look at the behavior applied to this conditional wave function in a Bohmian universe, you find it collapses in exactly the textbook manner. And I want to explain to you why that's true. I could give it as a homework problem, but it'd probably be better. I think it's better to do it. So let's consider a typical measurement situation. We have a system whose initial wave function is psi of x, and an apparatus which begins, which has a ready state y. By the way, now I'm letting, let's just imagine that the environment is just the apparatus. We have the system and then the environment, that's just the apparatus, don't worry about the rest of the universe. So we have an initial wave function like that, which I'll call capital Psi of x and y, just capital Psi times 0, that wave function. If this is, and suppose what we're doing here is, let me write the Psi as a sum. Let me decompose the initial wave function of the system according to some basis, namely the basis of eigenvectors of the observable we're measuring. Suppose we're considering a measurement of a certain observable A. Then I'm expanding here the basis, eigenbasis, eigenvectors of that observable A, because I want to show that you get the collapse to one of the eigenvectors of that observable A when we perform such a measurement. Well, we know from measurement theory how this must evolve. That's what it means to the measurement theory, to the measurement of the observable A. It means that this will evolve as follows. If we consider just one of the terms, the psi alpha term, this will evolve to a state psi alpha x times, let's say, phi alpha of y. If we take the sum, we have the sum of the terms, we have evolved to that sum. Now, what are these phi alphas of y? These are macroscopically completely different states. We can tell them unambiguously. You should think the following way. You should think that we have a pointer which might point in one of several different directions. The different alphas correspond to the different directions the pointer might point in. And what this measurement does is somehow set up a correlation between the way the pointer is pointing and the initial state of the system. This is standard measurement analysis, which I assume you've seen here. Now, to be more concrete about it, let me somehow represent in a one-dimensional way this vast configuration space for the y variable for the environment. We have disjoint sets here corresponding to these different values of alpha. And we have these wave functions, phi alpha 1, these different phi alphas here have disjoint supports. They correspond to the most important thing about this. One reason it's good to think of this as one-dimensional is the most important variable is for the purposes of reading off the results of the measurement is the orientation of the pointer. So think of the main, think, focus mainly on the orientation of the pointer. So in these different states here, the pointers are pointing in very different directions. They have main point is with these states by alpha, that there's joint support, as indicated. That's the standard measurement situation. I've said nothing wrong here. Now let's see what happens in this situation when the conditional wave function, the wave function. The initial wave function is psi. That's easy to see. That sounds. Just think about it for a minute. Almost the words for that. Let's start off and see. What is the wave function? This is, so we have an initial wave function psi at t equals 0. What about psi t? The conditional wave function times 2. Well, I have to, let me give this a name. This is psi, capital psi, written here on x and t, of x and y, times t. So I have to, this is equal to capital psi at time t of little x and capital y at time t. Now, where will capital Y at time t be? Be in one of these pieces. It'll be somewhere, and it has to be in one of these pieces. Any other possibility has zero probability. So therefore, then what we get here is this is equal to the sum C alpha psi alpha x phi alpha y t, where only one of these terms is not zero. The one is the support yt is. So if the situation is as I've drawn it here, where yt is the support of alpha 3, then only the third, the alpha 3 term will be relevant, and we would have something proportional to psi alpha 3. Everything else is just a constant, which you can ignore constant. It's what they get washed away in normalization anyway. And so the final wave function of the situation was as I described it. Final wave function of the system is psi alpha 3. And in general, what we have here is initial wave function psi goes to some final wave function psi, collapses to some final wave function psi alpha with probability C alpha squared, which is the usual collapse rule. Exactly the usual collapse rule. That's exactly what happens. I give you as another homework problem to show that that's true in this situation. These are the probabilities. And for that, I should make explicit what I intended implicitly here. These phi alphas and psi alphas are normalized. That's why I have the C alphas. Those are normalized. See what you get. And you figure out what the probabilities of the various possibilities. It's like a homework problem. Okay. So that is how, as a consequence of Bohmian mechanics, collapse follows. Bohmian mechanics and quantum equilibrium. Yes. Well, that's a good question. Maybe I'll get to that a little bit later. What I'm saying here is, there's a rule. How do you know it in quantum theory? Orthodox quantum theory is an excellent question. How do you know it in orthodox quantum theory? You just say you're told this is a measurement. You don't know why you're measuring what it is. What I'm saying here is the following. If you're doing the same thing you're doing in orthodox theory, whatever that may be, you're going to find collapse happen. Now, I think I'm going to get to a partial answer to your question a little later if we have time. Let's see. Good. I want to talk about now a collection of related, or not maybe even not so related, points which I think need to be mentioned. The following issues. I want to talk first about non-locality and hidden variables. I want to talk about, make a bunch of comments about properties of quantum observables. And I want to make a few remarks, although cryptic character, which I'll simply represent this way for the moment. Psi x psi question mark. That's more to remind me that I have to remember to talk about that a little bit. So you, it should be sort of a little bit mysterious. It's often, now concerning this first point, let me just, you know that quantum mechanics is non-local. Well, maybe you know it, maybe. I don't know how much it's been discussed about. Quantum mechanics is famously non-local. It's often said, however, and Bohmian mechanics is very quite non-local, because it involves a wave function on configuration space, which tends to be entangled, typically as entangled. If it's entangled, entanglement sort of smacks of non-locality. The entanglement leads to non-locality in the Bohmian equation. Bohmian mechanics is non-local. It would be good to give you some examples of that, but I just don't think we have time. Now, it's often said that one of the problems with Bohmian mechanics is the following. That non-locality is the price to pay if you want to have a theory, like a hidden variable theory like Bohmian mechanics. There's a price, non-locality. You're going to be stubborn and insist on hidden variables. Okay, you have to pay this price. Otherwise, you're flying, you don't have to worry about it. I think this is a big mistake. And I simply want to convey to you something Bell insisted upon for a long, long time, much to his frustration, people tend to ignore it. Well, the Bell argument for non-locality is a two-part argument. That's the essential point. Two-part argument. If you don't split it in two, you're likely to draw incorrect conclusions or misleading conclusions about the state of things. The first part is the Bell non-locality argument. The first part of the argument is EPR. Let's say in the Bohm version involving spins. EPR Bohm involving spin correlations. Now the point of the EPR argument was, either the original EPR Einstein Podolsky Rosen version or the simpler version that Bohm thought of. I'm not going to give you the argument, but it led to the following conclusion. Because if you take certain predictions of quantum mechanics for certain spin correlations of two spin one-half particles, just the predictions, that's why I put quantum mechanics in quotes. Not all the quantum mechanics that you need, just the certain predictions about certain special observation spin correlations. You just take those. And if the further you assume locality, Einstein didn't make a big deal of this assumption of locality, just took it for granted, and thought every sane person would assume locality. You assume locality, you find that there are hidden variables. This was an argument. The title of Einstein's EPR paper is Does a wave function provide a complete description of physical reality? What would it mean for it not to be complete? There's more of the hidden variables. What are the nature of the hidden variables? They are the pre-existing values of the quantities observed. Assuming locality, Einstein argued, the quantities observed, spin components in the case of the Bohm version, had to exist beforehand, merely revealed by measurement. That's the first part of the argument. Assuming that you have hidden variables, assume with certain assumptions. Second part of the argument was the Bell contribution. The Bell argument was the following. Just look at quantum mechanics alone. The very same spin correlations that Einstein Bohm considered, plus a few more detailed spin correlations. Same kind of thing. Then, with no further assumption, you'll find that the very kinds of hidden variables, which were the conclusion, whose existence was the conclusion of the first argument, are impossible. Now, the argument here is, there are many arguments of this flavor, but the argument I wrote down, the hardy sum paradox, I don't know what I called it the other day, is a proof of that kind. You get into a contradiction by assuming pre-existing values for a certain quantity. The contribution was that something which should have, on one hand, it had probability zero, should have had 9%. That was the original thing I said, mentioned way at the beginning. Similar kind of argument here. If you had, in quantum mechanics, very predictions of quantum mechanics shows that if you had these hidden variables, you'd have a contradiction. So there are no hidden variables. Good. That's the two-part argument, and it, of course, has a conclusion. What is the conclusion for these two statements? We clearly have a contradiction. H variables, no invariants. So something, one of the assumptions is wrong. If quantum mechanics is right, then that locality is wrong. Can't have both. We don't want to give up quantum mechanics because we like it, number one, because it's particular predictions have been verified anyway, so it's true. I think it's true. Trust the experiment. So the conclusion is, if quantum mechanics is non-local, and in fact nature is non-local, it's quantum mechanics is right. Predictions are wrong. Now, that's the situation. This is how Bell emphasized the argument should be thought of. Very clean, two-part argument. The mistake is often made is focusing only on the second part, putting a locality assumption there, which you don't need. Yeah. Well, whatever. I mean, it's still, I don't know. He doesn't think that he's doing anything very original for the first part. He may imagine he's saying it a little bit better than he does. I don't know. It's two lines versus four pages. That's likely to be clear. Gets to the point rather quickly. That was also a problem with Bell, of course. He just got to the point, said exactly the right things, no irrelevant stuff, but that made it hard for a lot of people to appreciate what he was saying. In any case, the basic structure of this argument, I should say, is really the following. We'd better to leave hidden variables out of it entirely. Having the fact that you'll put the subject of hidden variables there makes you think that there's something, that hidden variables might be the source of the trouble. And the best way to think about the structure of this argument is that the first part is quantum mechanics plus locality implies some conclusion C. The second part says quantum mechanics, no further assumptions, implies not C. It doesn't really matter what C is. C is something that will do everything, which can be false anyway. Its identity is not very important for the argument. C goes away, since this is the contradiction. The conclusion is that quantum mechanics is right, not locality. Okay. That's the first remark I want to put in. Of course, it's true that quantum mechanics implies there are no hidden variables, in some sense. That remains a fact. So you should, again, be puzzled, how is quantum mechanics possible? I've already explained to you that Bohmian mechanics will account for all these experiments. It's a counterexample to all the no hidden variable theorems. That's a simple fact. This is also a simple fact. Quantum mechanics implies there are somehow no pre-existing bias on these experiments. This should be puzzling. And how many people are puzzled by that? Good. How many people are not puzzled because they understand it? Only you, Dusty. Yeah. There may be a causality, but whatever else there is, there's non-locality, I would say. All I mean by non-locality is spooky action is that somehow or other you do something over here that has to be an effect part of it. That's true. Still, I don't whether if I do something over here and something happens far away, whether I observe it or not, I call that non-locality. There are two versions of the argument. That's the one he says, note well of the following argument, I shall not mention the words hidden variable. Here I did mention, this was his first argument. You can make it precise, but I think if you don't know what it means to start with, you're in trouble. Because you don't understand the significance of the mathematical precise thing there. have an unusual situation. Yes, I agree. We have an, the logic here is that we have an unusual. People have tried for many years to come up with a better way of thinking, and I've wondered about that too. I don't believe there's a better way of thinking. When I'm open to see it, I like to see the better way of thinking. It's not as if this is just 30 years old. People thought really hard about it. There have been thousands of papers trying to say there's really no problem with a better way of thinking. Most of those papers are deeply disappointing. Yeah. No. You're right to be puzzled. I want you to be puzzled because you have to. I'm going to explain exactly. I'm saying certainly that Bohmian mechanics is not a hidden variable theory in the sense that hidden variables are impossible. But the thing that should be puzzling you is what could be the two senses? And in one sense possible, and the other sense not possible. So that's. Here, it really, what was really meant were pre-existing values of the relevant observable state. I'm not going to leave it at this. I want to say a few more things which will try to flesh, get to actually the relevant distinction so you will understand what's going on. But right now, on the basis of what I said so far, it should just be puzzling. And this is a normal kind of puzzle that most people have about this subject. There's a sharp answer to it, and I want to get to it. The sharp answer has to do with the following question. Now, so basically, I want to start talking about properties and other quantum observables. What kind of properties does a Bohmian system have? So let me raise a sequence of questions related to that. All questions one should reflect upon. What properties is the Bohmian particle? Or system have? They certainly have positions. What are the properties? Or, to say the same thing in a different way, do Bohmian particles have only positions? That's all I talked about. No other properties? I don't know how this strikes you. Do Bohmian particles, let's mention some other properties. What about momentum? What about spin? What about all the other observables in quantum mechanics? You should all be wonder something about, you should somehow wonder about all of these things. And I do want to say a few words about all of these things. Let me begin with these two questions. What properties do Bohmian particles have? What about other properties? What properties a Bohmian particle has, or a Bohmian system has, are just the properties it would have by the very nature of the thing it is. The Bohmian system is a collection of particles governed by certain laws. It'll have whatever properties systems, particles governed by those laws of motion have. For example, this is a Bohmian system. It has the property that if I push on it, it doesn't bend very much. It has the property of being hard. It responds to interactions in a certain way by virtue of the laws. It has the property of being hard. This should seem to you a triviality. It is. Bohmian systems have lots of properties the way everything else has lots of properties. The notion of property is a fairly trivial thing. It's a disposition to behave in a certain way. That takes care of those two. What about momentum in particular? Now I want to raise a problem. This should puzzle you as well. Let's think about the ground state of a hydrogen atom. The electron in the ground state of an atom. Its wave function is basically real. The Fourier transform in the ground state is something spread out like that too. Different shape, but still spread out. The Fourier transform being spread out means the momentum distribution is spread out. It is a prediction there's some spread in the momentum distribution in the ground state. Momentum distribution, the momentum is not exactly zero in probability one. It's exactly zero in probability zero. It's spread out. What about the velocity of the bulkhead particle in the ground state? The formula we had for the velocity was the QDT equals something times the imaginary part of something involving the wave function. If the wave function is real, then the imaginary part is zero. We get zero. The velocity is zero. The particle v equals zero. The velocity distribution is peaked at zero. That's the only velocity, the Bohmian velocity. So the Bohmian momentum, if you call it momentum, mass times velocity, what you might think of as a Bohmian momentum, in other words, is definitely zero. Therefore, I raise the question, do we not have here in front of us a clear example of empirical disagreement between Bohmian and energy and other components? So how many of you does it seem like we have clear empirical disagreement? Now, how many of you does it not seem like there's any disagreement? Yeah, the more sophisticated people who know already, it should seem like there's disagreement. Now, why is there no disagreement? Empirical equivalence means equivalence in the result predictions, the result experiments. So we would have to consider how likely we might come to know the momentum of the particle in quantum theory and compare what Bohmian mechanics would say about exactly the same procedure. Now, that procedure is, whatever procedure that is, that's going to lead to some spread of the result, and it'll lead to the same spread of the result for Bohmian mechanics as for orthodox quantum theory. One way of doing the measurement, for example, would be to take away all interactions, let this particle move freely, see how far it gets after a long time, and see what the distribution is of the position after a long time. As a matter of fact, it's not hard to see that the distribution after a long time is going to be governed by the Fourier transform of the wave function, and what you'll end up with is for the distribution of momentum defined in terms of some sort of asymptotic velocity to get exactly the usual form. What about spin? Again, I did nothing to Bohmian mechanics to deal with spin. I just used the usual spinner valued wave function. Let's see what happens in the famous Stern-Gerlach experiment. We send in a wave packet to a particle in a spin state. It's a superposition of spin up and spin down in the z direction. I have a Stern-Gerlach magnet here oriented in the z direction. What the effect of this magnet is to split the beam into an up piece and a down piece. Then we have detectors over there, which should detect the particle either up or down. You detect it up, you say the spin was up. You detect it down, you say the spin was down. And the measurement problem says, well, why do you detect it in one place or the other? It's in both places, the wave function temple. What does a Bohmian particle do? Deterministic, and depending on where it starts, it will either, if it starts, for example, up, it's likely to go up and ends up in the up beam, and you will find it up, and you'll say the spin is up. If it starts somewhere else, like down, it'll probably go down, so it's just down. That's how spin measurements come out in Bohmian mechanics. No problem whatsoever, it's perfectly clear. Now I want to come to general observables, general quantum observables, really general observables. What are general quantum observables? Nowadays, we've gone way beyond self-joint operators observables. Work in quantum optics, I guess quantum information theory as well, has suggested very strongly we should broaden the notion of observables with something called positive operator valued measures. So I will explain to you why, from a Bohmian perspective, these are just perfectly natural. Here's the argument, the analysis. Let's consider a general interaction, a general experiment on a system, completely general experiment. We start off with a system in a certain wave function. The general experiment is if the system will interact with something else, some piece of the rest of the world, which I'll call the apparatus, which will be start off with some ready state, which I'll call psi zero. And I want to consider how everything ends up depending on the initial wave function. So we start with an initial wave function psi, and I take into account interaction with the apparatus. It's fixed. I have a state like this initially. And then if, when the systems interact, however it is, they're going to end up with some final state, psi t, which results from the unitary evolution, taking into account the interaction between system and apparatus, applied to the original, what we call this state, capital psi 0, applied to capital psi 0. So that's just, and this t is the final time of the experiment ends at count capital T. Whatever experiment it is, the wave function can evolve in a way that did that in a manner like that. Unitary evolution. Now let's consider a few more steps. What are we really interested in the of the experiment? This is bad. This should be a phi. Phi refers to apparatus. Psi, capital psi, refers to system times apparatus. We're interested in the distribution of the results. Let me call the result z. In general, the result of the experiment is going to be some function of the final configuration of system and apparatus. In practice, it will depend only on the apparatus. In practice, in fact, it will be something like the orientation of a pointer in the apparatus. That will give the result. But this could be any function of the final configuration of system and apparatus. It has a certain distribution. Let me get to that. First of all, let's now map from this to rho psi t. This is equals psi t squared dq. The quantum equilibrium distribution for the final configuration of system and apparatus. This determines, by one next step, rho psi t proposed with F inverse, which is the distribution of the result, f of 2t. What I have on the board here is a sequence of maps taking you from the initial wave function of the system to the thing you're interested in, the probability distribution of the result. That's a good thing to know if you want to systematically, in an organized way, talk about the statistics for the result of measurements of this kind, experiments of this kind, given by this kind of apparatus, this kind of unitary evolution. This map, this sequence of maps, have some rather obvious features. That is some rather obvious features. All of the maps here are linear, except for one. This is linear. Psi here, first power. Psi here, first power. This is clearly linear. The Schrodinger's evolution is linear, unitary map. This is quadratic, squared. This is another linear map. So we have sequence of maps, most of which are trivially linear, and one of which is a little bit non-trivially linear, but it's linear to the unitary, the Schrodinger evolution is linear. And then there's one quadratic map. So for the overall map, from psi to the distribution of the result, z, mu psi, I call that mu psi, distribution of the result, this map, psi to mu psi, is quadratic. We have a quadratic map from wave function to probability distribution. These will only be probability distributions when psi is normalized, otherwise, they'll be non-normalized probability distribution. We have a quadratic map. How could you have such a map? The simplest example of such a map is just the form of the probabilities from the results of measurements of quantum observables. The form is the following. You have a given any observable A, you have spectral projections E, dz, projections onto this infinitesimal region corresponding to the result z and dz, corresponding to all the eigenprojections, linear combinations of all eigenvectors in there. Then the probability for the result of the measurement of A will be in dz will be given by that formula, which is clearly quadratic. But to get, so this is a nice way to get a quadratic map from wave functions, the probability distribution. But this way of getting a map clearly wasn't important to EV. A projection, a positive operator, would be just as good. When you replace projections by positive operators, you replace projection volume measures by positive operator value measures, PODMs. This is a simple example of how you would get positive operator value. And the important point is, a simple functional analysis tells you that all positive operator values exist. All positive operator value measures arise in this way. So whenever you have a quadratic, this is a simple example how from a positive operator value measure, you get a quadratic map. All quadratic maps arise in this way. Simple exercise of functional analysis. So in particular, this one does. It matches quadratic. So the results of the experiment, the distribution of the results of the experiment, must be given by a positive operator value measure. So a positive operator value measure, by structural theory of N, must be associated with every experiment as an efficient device for organizing the statistics of the results. That, from a Bohmian perspective, is how operators as observables emerge from an operational point of view. The same thing can be said for orthodox quantum theory. Most of what I did here, almost all of it, had nothing to do with Bohmian mechanics. So even from an orthodox perspective, you should think of operators as observables merely as convenient objects for organizing the statistics for the result and nothing more. And if you do that, you avoid all kinds of confusion. And if you think about that carefully, you also realize why there's no problem here. Now I'll come to that. The known hidden variable theorems are all of the following form. They all say this. They say there's no hidden variable theorems. Say that there's no good map from. The simplest example of a positive operator value measure is a projection value measure corresponding to the ordinary quantum observable, the self-adjoint operator. Let me get back to just talking about self-adjoint operators. Usual quantum observables is not the more general class, just for simplicity. That there's no hidden variable theorem, say there's no good map, quantum observables, operators A, to random variables on some common probability space. You want to have all or a large number of the quantum observables mapped to random variables all on a common probability space. You should think of the omega here, the point of the probability space, as corresponding to the hidden variable, the thing that determines the result of the measurement of that observable. In Bohmian mechanics, it would be the configuration of the system and apparatus at hand. For a Bohmian measurement of spin, all you would need, the apparatus is sort of trivial. It's just this magnet. It doesn't introduce anything configurational. To all intents and purposes, it's just a magnet. And so for a Bohmian mechanics, the relevant thing would be just the configuration, the positions of two particles, if you're talking about measurements of systems of particles, just the position. The omega is in the just. The statement is there's no good math like that, where good means the following. It has a minimal meaning. It means merely that the joint distributions you have with these things cannot agree. Good would mean it agrees with the quantum mechanical distributions, where the quantum mechanical distributions are defined. The quantum mechanical distributions are defined with collections of commuting observables. You have commuting observables, you have joint distributions for them. The joint distributions of these can't agree with the quantum mechanical joint distributions. That's the content, that's the substance of no hidden variable theory. No such thing. What I've assumed the map is merely, it would seem, empirical agreement with quantum mechanics. I make no crazy assumption, just something I have to get out the right point. And yet, Bohmian mechanics seems to give us such a map. So again, the question is raised, what gives? How could Bohmian mechanics exist? How can there be no such map when Bohmian mechanics simply seems to trivially give you such a map? Let's see what we actually have. Suppose we have an experiment E. I've said that it's associated with some positive operator value measure. If it's a special experiment, it'll be self-adjoint operator that's associated with it. And what it's directly associated with will be the distribution of the result of the experiment, depending on what the state is. We might have a different experiment, E prime, which will give us a different result function, C psi prime, which, however, the probabilities might be such that these are both associated with the same observable. we might very well have different experiments associated with the same operator A. These two different experiments might very well have probably give rise to probabilities which are organized, conveniently expressed in terms of the same mathematical object, the operator A. So we have this natural map from Z to A. From random variables to observables, quantum observables, operators really, just operators. But what this says we cannot have is a map in the other direction. Well, there's nothing saying you should have a map in the other direction. If there was no reason why you should be able to go backwards, and in this particular case, you have two different experiments associated with the same operator, there's no way you could go backwards. Various totally different experiments could end up somehow accidentally being associated with the same operator. You get into trouble here when you think that actually, without paying attention to the details of the experiment, but just knowing what operator was associated with it, that should determine the random variable, the further details being irrelevant. But why should the details of the experiment be irrelevant? Obviously, it depends on what experiment you do, the result you get. So there, in fact, the problem here has nothing to do with demanding to write probabilities. The problem has to do with assuming it's enough to specify an operator, an abstract operator, to know what experiment you're talking about. Why would you think this is good at all? Because there's a pervasive, naive realism about operators, which is ingrained in us because of the way quantum mechanics is taught. We're taught with the observables of the quantum system, what replaced the classical properties, the quantum properties, are operators. We tend to take this language not in a positivistic sense, not in an operational sense, but as these are the real properties. So if we're going to make a hidden variable theory, these things should have values. They're all things, all the properties should have values. But these aren't properties. These are convenient devices for expressing the statistics of results. If you avoid naive realism about operators, if you're not seduced by naive realism about operators, you realize this is not a reasonable assumption at all, and that those hidden variable theorems prove very little. Okay, now, what's left here? This. And this is just going to be some summarizing statements of the lessons, I would say, the key lessons of Bohmian mechanics. Bohmian mechanics is a specific theory, as I mentioned at the beginning, but there are some lessons which go way beyond Bohmian mechanics. I think these are the most important lessons. The point of this X here is to indicate that Bohmian mechanics, Einstein always felt that the wave function could not be a complete description. You needed to add something to it. In Bohmian mechanics, what it shows that you don't have to be very imaginative. You could just add the positions of the particles. You get a perfectly acceptable theory. X meant to suggest that you might have, there are other possibilities of what you might add, the string theory, the field theory. You shouldn't think that positions are the be-all and the end-all. There might be all better alternatives when it comes to other areas of physics, or even for non-relativistic quantum mechanics, who knows? The question mark means it might not be at all obvious what choice we should make. Let me give you two examples for possibilities for X. Two extreme examples. The first example is one we've been talking about, X equals Q, the positions of the particles, as we have in Bohmian mechanics. The obvious ontology evolving in the obvious way, certainly this is an obvious choice. The point I want to make is the choice need not be at all obvious. Bohmian mechanics gives the wrong impression if it suggests that you should always make an obvious just positions of particles. Here's another choice. Can't write down a variable, I'll just say flashes. This goes back to Bell and most recently to Roderick Tumulco, where there's a GRW-like or really a Bohm-like theory where the ontology is highly surprising, highly unusual. It's the following. Particles means in space-time you have world line. It's the normal ontology. Flashes means you don't have world lines, you have points in space-time. Flashy ontology governed by probabilities means reality is a point process in space-time. This is a novel ontology, which suggests in particular, which says in particular, that any typical time is nothing. Just flashes, at least flashes, just a metaphor, just a word, I don't really mean any flash and light going on. I mean, the ontology is just points. Now, the point is, you can make perfectly good sense of this theory, and such an ontology would work. And it actually serves some useful purposes, and in fact, we can come up with a theory which is roughly equivalent to orthodox quantum theory based on this ontology, which is fully Lorentz invariant, and Robert Simolka has shown how to do that. It's generalizing the work of Bell to a fully relativistic framework. I can't give any details to that, but what's essential there, what Bell recognized, was that getting the symmetry property on, ultimately Lorentz invariant, depended crucially on a proper choice of ontology, a very surprising choice. Most of you sitting there should think, I can't even understand how that could make any sense. That would be a normal reaction. It does make sense, ultimately. You have to be open to really surprising possibilities. Ultimate ontology, the one that does the best work for you, might be quite something that requires a lot of imagination. Might be very surprising. Now, let me emphasize, as I'm about to close, that this adds the extra thing you add to the wave function of Bohmian theory is absolutely crucial. The thing that's left out in orthodox theory, I sense, is crucial to the theory from a Bohmian perspective, perhaps for any perspective, really. It's crucial to the very formulation of the theory, not just its interpretation, but the formulation of the theory. It's the point of the whole theory. This is what the theory is about, the behavior of X. More precisely, the point of the theory is to explain data, observations, in terms of the behavior of X. And finally, the right X might turn out for future physics to play a decisive role in developing that theory. Choice of ontology can have precise, powerful implications for the physics it develops, for all kinds of problems. So I think the most important lesson is exploring future possibilities for physics to get beyond the dogma that the wave function is the complete description and start thinking seriously about what the theory is about and what is its ontology. That's all I have to say. That's an excellent question. I don't know. The question was, how does it... My point was that there's an essential difference in Bohmian mechanics between the way one thinks about the quantum observables merely as devices for being described as statistics results than the way an orthodox quantum physicist does. I find it surprising, because I think an orthodox physicist with their positivistic orientation should say, be even more inclined to say the same thing. So I somehow think it's an example where there's a certain confusion developed and just propagated, a confusion which is even inconsistent with the positivism, which was played an essential role in the development of acceptance of the Copenhagen interpretation. Very positive. What do they say when they're faced with that? I mean, what does someone say who hasn't really thought it all through? The typical person, what Bohr would say is, yes, I of course agree, you shouldn't think of observables that way, presumably. He would be in a bit of a trouble. But what? I would say 10 different physicists would say 10 different things. Yeah, I think that's a wonder. How do you know what? The question is, since psi is kind of a mysterious thing, and the fundamental thing in the theory is the x, how do you know what psi is at all? Now, I think that's a really good question, important question, not just for Bohmian mechanics, but really for orthodox quantum theory as well, because it's just as inaccessible there in some sense. How do you know? But here you have, I think Bohmian mechanics provides a good framework to begin addressing that question in a serious way. And a related question would be, going back to the definitions of size, which do seem to manipulate, not the wave function of the universe. Now, you or Bell would worry about the wave function of the universe. Most physicists would worry about more pedestrian wave function. But I define the wave function of a subsystem this way. And you have to know two big deals here. You have to know the wave function of the universe in this definition. You have to know the detailed configuration of the environment. And that's what's involved in the definition. But of course, that's not how you want. It's good to have something well-defined, but then how you actually get your hands on something is a different matter. But then the question would be, and I think this is a translation of your question, I think it's a good subject for further research. What algorithm do we actually use in practice to get our hands on that object? It'd be well worth exploring that. Yeah. Why'd you say you're stuck with the measurement problem? Now, the measurement problem basically, what you're talking about, I think, is probably some different question. The measurement problem is, why do measurements have results at all? Measurements have results in Bohmian mechanics because pointers point in Bohmian mechanics. Why do pointers point? Because you have particles at positions always. Wave functions get spread out, but configurations are what they are. So there's no measurement problem like that. Now, another question you might have is, why do wave functions collapse? But if you look at what you mean by the wave function of a system, it does collapse as well. And let me see, what question remains then? Certainly doesn't arise here because I gave you an exact formula, and I simply so you see exactly what's happening in detail. And you ask, is there some system? Can I say what happens when I analyze a measurement? What happens to this object? And you find that it goes through a transition from an additional wave function, whatever it is, to a random result. One of the eigenstates, it's a collapse of one of those things. You see that happening. You see with the right probabilities. And where do the probabilities come from? Why is the result random? Well, why should anything be random? Because the initial, because this isn't for quantum equilibrium, the initial configuration is random. So depending upon what the initial configuration is, the final y will be one thing or another. So you end up with a random result. No, that quickly happens. But even if, for example, if the supports are disjoint, even if they were very close together, the formula would be valid. But to be confident the future Schrodinger evolution would apply, the Schrodinger evolution would apply to the collapsed wave functions, then you would need decoherence or disjointness and so on. So if your question is, why then are you justified in using the Schrodinger evolution as a collapsed wave function, that has to do actually more with the first claim I made about the behavior of psi t, that it gives the Schrodinger evolution in appropriate circumstances. That if those collapse, I don't need to invoke decoherence. That you can forget about the rest and just use the Schrodinger evolution for the collapse wave function to get the future evolution of the conditional wave function requires things like decoherence to prevent future overlap, which would mess things up. It's a matter of practice. It is just a practice. It's for all practical purposes question. It's the kind of question that's appropriate. There's no conceptual issue anymore. It's just a question of when are certain approximations good approximations? That they are enormously good approximations. Yeah. Well, there's X and there's Y. in general, different X or different Y or different bones, whatever, will give different results. If we were thinking, however, about Stern-Gerlach measurements, there's no initial Y to be relevant. And it says all the randomness is going to come from randomness in the initial X in that case. For a general measurement, randomness in the apparatus could, as well as randomness in the system, configuration of the apparatus and the configuration of the system, will contribute to randomness in the result. But to think about the simple no-hit variable theorem in any case, all you need to work in terms of spins and Stern-Gerlach magnets, all you have to do is worry about randomness of the system itself, configurations of the spin one half particles. Yes, it's because of quantum equilibrium. That goes back to the question of absolute uncertainty in quantum equilibrium. It's all contingent on quantum equilibrium. That's why a full understanding of all this requires a full understanding of quantum equilibrium. It's possible, when we're in a systematic analysis to see how that goes, and maybe Anthony will talk about it, all sorts of possibilities will be opened up. Like quantum, if our world happened to be a quantum non-equilibrium world, I assume Anthony was talking about that. Right. The point is really this. It's a little bit of a subtle point. The idea is the following. Suppose I consider this wave function. Suppose I consider this set, this wave function. They can't both be normalized. You should regard them as physically equivalent. They lead to the same velocities. And you should think that the only value of normalization is if you're going to use a probability formula, the wave function better be normalized, so the psi squared will be a probability. This is the conventional view, by the way. There's nothing especially Bohmian here. The state in quantum, what's often said is that the state in quantum mechanics is the wave function. More precisely, what would be said is the state in quantum mechanics is the ray. All wave functions which are scalar multiple of each other describe the same physical state. What I'm saying is simply a mountain fact. Normalization doesn't matter because it's not a physical difference.